Hi, everyone. This is Austin Arrington, your host of Talk Dirty. Today is episode number one for November 2020. It's been a wild year, y'all, and I'm glad we are all here in this moment right now. Today's episode is The Internet of Plants. We have some really exciting guest speakers today, including Dr. Nadina Gale, an award-winning ecological engineer and entrepreneur working at the intersection of sustainability, technology, and urbanism. Okay, let's talk dirty.
We need to be feeling the plants from the inside out, okay?
Right.
I'm not saying don't do that, but like, here we go again, visualizing the plants as if they're separate from us, right? They're like, you're showing us our lungs.
That's Richard Doyle, professor of English and affiliate faculty in information science and technology at Penn State University. Rich is one of my mentors from my time at Penn State and has written a lot about plants, technology, and psychedelics.
Because I really think Bose, the Indian scientist who nobody knows from the early 20th century, like teens and 20s, mm-hmm. he's already seeing this. And it was only the there's a kind of like, forgive me for putting it this way because it's so clunky, but this kind of colonialist mindset that can't accept the metaphysics. So Bose is coming from this Vedanta metaphysics. It's like, of course the plants are all talking to each other. What do you think living things are? But it's of consciousness.
What are we talking about?
That, in other words, we observe the way consciousness works in us. And by observing the way consciousness works in us, we see the principles by which it works. So therefore, we look at a plant and we say, well, you know, I mean, like.
Yeah, yes. How do we know that's not just like personification or us just like, you know.
Because that tells me you haven't meditated enough. I mean, excuse me. Right. Because you meditate enough, you know the difference between where that comes from, that part of your brain where the personification comes from, was very late to the game, right? It's the conscious mind, right? And what comes out of the depths once you've silenced that conscious mind for long enough, you know? And, you know, all I would do is point to a very, very deep history where people say this over and over and over again. And they're seeing the same things that people are seeing with the, you know, fancy instruments. And that needs to be explained. You know what I mean? In the same way in which Johns Hopkins, NYU, these places that are being, quote-unquote, open to psychedelics, need to remember that, like, they get their asses kicked by Maria Sabina.
Maria Sabina?
Like, she's the one who introduced psilocybin mushrooms to the West. That they're completely ignoring the alternate forms of knowing because they don't even realize that they're kind of dwelling in a kind of mechanical informational worldview that is just the accepted premise because they believe their senses and they believe their education and they haven't done any first-person investigation of what the nature of mind is.
So I'm sort of like coming at it from a perspective of like, and as somebody who, frankly, I've worked in technology, I've built sensors, I'm like part of this whole framework. Like, I'm like, okay, can we use this mentality to at least get this in the public dialogue? And then
where is the public dialogue? Is there one?
I mean, there's like a whole lot of random stuff happening on the internet.
Exactly. That's not a public dialogue. But I think what you're pointing to is that can we illuminate something? And there I think you're totally right. Part of me still wants to say you can't get there from there. As soon as you externalize it like that, that really what is necessary right now is a widespread turning within, an investigation of the nature of mind, because without a whole lot of ego death among a whole lot of people, all we're going to do is like do a better job documenting the apocalypse.
Right. Okay, so you as an artist, as a writer, a rhetorician, I remember you gave me a few books after our time together in State College. And yeah, it was like one was sort of your ayahuasca and your plant consciousness journey, and then there's this other one about technology and like, so what's your whole story with like the internet and writing about this digital world in relation to the natural
world? Yeah, that was most of the work I did before I met you. That basically, I started working with personal computers in the mid-70s.
Wow.
Quite intensely. And experiencing, like, online bulletin boards then, even. Like, there were things like CompuServe, The Source, and these other electronic bulletin boards. And then I was a fairly early, not very remarkable member of the community in San Francisco once I was in graduate school, The Well, which was a dial-up Unix prompt that you could get that was, for a lot of people, the sort of very architecture of, like, what would the internet, like, look like? What was the internet for? And so the transformation of this kind of, like, bulletin board universe to the web universe that happened when I was visiting Stanford in, I guess it was post-Gopher, which was the FTP protocol that was developed at University of Wisconsin that really opened up a lot of things. Mm. But it was right when Mosaic had come out. Mm-hmm. And just before some of the people who ended up being, I'm pretty sure, involved in Yahoo and Google, they showed me essentially a search engine for the first time. And, you know, my mind was completely blown. And a lot of the people that I, you know, in my cohort and so forth got kind of swept up in a good way into, you know, startups and such. And I flirted with it. And I flirted with kind of some of the people later who were in a very interesting magazine that was happening in Berkeley at that time, which was kind of fusing psychedelic culture and cyber culture, is called Mondo 2000.
Damn, that sounds dope.
And it was reality hacking. It was called reality hacking. Hmm. This was extremely, like, Timothy Leary was kind of influential on that domain, but so too would Liam Gibson have been. Hmm. And there were, like, notable, Are You Serious? You interviewed me once. He was one of the people who was one of the architects of Mondo 2000. He's always got interesting things to say. I would encourage you to talk dirty with him.
Okay. Nice.
And there was a woman named Queen Mu, I think, that was like ended up being a game designer. So I kind of like traveled through these circles, and I feel like I was a little, like, one of the reasons I think I'm attracted to Philip K. Dick is that I think I was a kind of canary in a coal mine of what was coming in terms of, like, what the infoquake really meant. And so my dissertation was on the effects of tropes of information on the formation of the life sciences from Schrodinger to artificial life. And so I started to study the way in which our thinking was given its contours through these metaphors drawn from computer science and communication theory from Claude Shannon. And I started to see that there was a kind of perennial problem here, which is that, you know, there's the reductionist model, which scientific discourse is always attracted to because it allows you to break things up and study them in their parts and then put them back together again. Mm-hmm. But that other tension of seeing that, therefore, in the gestalt switch, right, shift, that you stop seeing the whole. And one of the things that we're not aware of is that when we use particular kind of language or metaphor or image to frame our thinking about something, that we forget that it is language or a metaphor or frame in our thinking, and we think it's our thinking. So I watched how these metaphors of information, I wasn't like alarmist about it, but I watched how it was like really altering our experience of what it means to be alive, because you know, the name of the book was On Beyond Living, after Dr. Seuss' On Beyond Zebra, which was suggesting that the technology had transformed our experience to the extent that the word life was no longer appropriate to where we were living, because we were really living an experience of what that I call the next volume that I wrote a trilogy on this, which I called Wetwares, after Rudy Rucker's science fiction novel Wetware, where, you know, wetware is the answer to the question of what goes with hardware and software, right? Wetware.
Wow.
And that as we were, whereas the first book was a kind of conceptual history of how had biologists started thinking about living systems in the context of information, and how had that sculpted their thinking and what the kind of world that came out the other side of it. Wetwares was more a focus on the culture that was emerging to sort of deal with that, right? So there were three chapters in that book on cryonics, actually, the free organized freezing of human bodies or heads for their future revival, because cryonics and its very basis, like the way in which people were imagining that cryonics was a reasonable transaction, and I very much write about it as a transaction, was predicated on this idea that human beings are fundamentally information processing systems, not only first and foremost, but in our essence, right? So that if you froze the body, essentially what you're doing was, you know, create a kind of hard disk snapshot for a future life that would be revived. Mm-hmm. And that got me interested in nanotechnology, because nanotechnology was the technology that was constantly pointed to as sort of licensing of that rather ambitious premise, right? That that information technology offered us a ticket to what could only be called immortality, right? Writing that book was a great experience, because I thought I was knew what I was writing that book about when I started, but I was so transformed by the interviewing that I did of people in the cryonics community and artificial life, and alien abduction community also, that I became convinced that something really weird was happening, that something that was neither bad nor good. Mm. But as I think I said in the jacket copy, but it is to be hoped is not worse than previous incarnations, right? Like, that there was hope, right? Like, it was seen as kind of monstrous. Like, the future was very, from my point of view, in 2000 to 2003, very Cronenberg, you know, the Canadian film director, David Cronenberg. So if you look at films like, Videodrome, that he's really prophesizing this very anxious, panicky kind of subject to extraordinary volatility, but nonetheless embodied state of anxiousness. Like, the key word of the book Wetwares was panic. Mm. But a lot of people didn't like that book because I appeared to enjoy the panic. You know, like, so,
yeah.
And I refused to denounce or affirm. I was just like, this is what it looks like.
Right.
Not sure we can survive it, but probably we will, because we're evolutionary beings. And then I moved on to Darwin's Pharmacy at that point, because in all this research, I had found that, because what I was really tracking as a kind of cultural totem was DNA. And I found that psychedelic trip reports had an awfully predictable propensity to invoking DNA at some point. Hmm. And why was that? You know, I wanted to know the answer to that. Is somehow the figure of DNA of the double helix allowing us to sort of imagine this next evolutionary turn of the screw that we were already starting to experience, even in, say, 93, 94. I wrote the first bit of that at 97. And then, you know, as a part of the research for that, I drank ayahuasca in 2002, and that, like, pulled me inside out in a way that was more informational. And so that gave me kind of, that made me less interested in continuing to track information technology and more interested in seeing, well, what were the resources by which we could use the mind to act on the mind, mm-hmm. which occurred under the influence of and teaching of ayahuasca and Norma Pandoro. And then that's where I just, and I had such an opening out of this and such a healing that I had to sort of open all the doors and look at all the books and all the stuff. And that was where I really started to understand, even though I had a deep attraction and interest in Philip K. Dick, start to understand what I think that Philip K. Dick had experienced as a metanoia, a change of mind. And that's when I engaged in the exegesis project where we were working on editing the exegesis, and I do think that the exegesis is probably the single greatest source of kind of data on the phenomenology of what happens to human beings when they start to treat themselves as self-aware information, right? That and John Lilly's book, amazing book, Programming and Metaprogramming, the human body. They're written within a decade of each other. And so it turned me on to the way in which neuroscience was really, like, at least as I experienced it, only beginning to scratch the surface, open the door, get a sense on how important it is that we're self-aware beings and that we can feed back onto ourselves and alter ourselves with extraordinary results. And people, that starts to sound creepily like Scientology or something. So I think that what we've seen with the effect, the feedback loop between psychedelics and information technology is that you see a culture that had been mechanical and reductionistic, like that of, say, 1960s psychology or life sciences or computer science. And then they discover not just the surface level of their brain and externalize that, right? So they don't just externalize ego, that's the Industrial Revolution in a way, but they see that there are all these other layers of complexity. And then, you know, I think it's worth recalling, you know, Steve Jobs' yearly reading, apparently, of a book by Richard Rohr's book called Cosmic Consciousness, and another book, the autobiography of Yogananda. Right, great Indian teacher, that you kind of get a glimpse of that, and then your life becomes this practice of integrating that glimpse into those parts of the world that you get to design, right? And so they start to mirror each other, and that's beautiful, and that's why, you know, contemporary information technology feels kind of psychedelic, and why it seems like such a prophet. Right, you know, because he was noticing the analogy between those two things very early on. But the problem is that, you know, as you well know, since you already worked in the technology sector, that, you know, neoliberal capitalism wants to take its cut, right? So it's not like we're fully integrating this vision of the imminence of intelligence. In right, immanence, but we're just kind of like producing a simulacrum of the way in which plants and other, you know, aspects of conscious nature are imminent to our system, and so we're taking a kind of snapshot, and we're taking that to be the thing in order to keep the whole ego franchise going. Right? It's just like, yeah, how can we, like, have this psychedelic experience and still all be separate and, like, have, you know, unique credit ratings and so forth and names and everything, you know? Because psychedelic experience teaches us that that's a very epiphenomenal layer to our experience. It's not meaningless. Our uniqueness is precious and important, and individuation is a real thing, but individuation and separation are not the same thing. And, you know, capitalism as it has thus far developed takes individuation and separation to be synonyms for each other, right? Mm. But individuation, as you know, because, like, you know, you're married and, like, you have kids, right? Or no?
No, not yet.
You know, but still, you're married. Like, you know that you start to form a collective. Mm. And, like, individuation happens because of our complicity with other things. You know, like, I was reading the poet Hopkins this morning, and, like, he's trying to figure out where the dew stops and the berry starts, I think, you know? your attention, again, to go back to that gestalt shift, your attention is drawn to that. It's like, oh, so the world is not actually made up of this kind of separation, that is equally made up out of this separation as this continuity.
Okay, so I know that was a little bit of an unexpected detour, but I think we're all on the same page now.
Okay.
Well, not enough content about plants and trees, in my opinion, so I think we're definitely hitting still a niche there.
Okay, well, I hope so. Yeah, so basically, I don't know, kind of embarrassing, but maybe not, but I feel like I saw you first on LinkedIn, and I was like, whoa, this is really cool, because I had never heard that, the term you were using, the Internet of Nature, you know, and I liked that it was kind of like a play on the Internet of Things, or that's what it seemed like to me. Mm-hmm. So what is the Internet mm-hmm. of Nature?
Well, I think before we get into that, it's important to realize that, so basically where a lot of the inspiration for the Internet of Nature comes from, other than, of course, the play on words from a technological sense, it comes from this idea that for centuries we've known that plants and trees talk to each other via these what's called mycorrhizal fungi networks that colonize, you know, a plant's root system and then develop this kind of symbiotic association with each other. And then these fungi and these roots basically have what I like to call, you know, the world's longest standing trading agreement, in the sense that it's a symbiotic relationship. And they can exchange nutrients and water and carbon and even information like defense signals about pests and disease, for example. Mm. And these fungal networks that have kept forests and plant systems self-regulating and self-sufficient for hundreds of millions of years in cities can actually be quite fragmented. And because these trees and plants evolve to help their neighbors through this communication network, I often wondered about what that might look like in a city, and are they physically blocked from doing so? And if so, could that be a potential cause for poor soil health or perhaps even high mortality rates amongst urban trees? And since we can't afford to lose urban nature because, you know, for a whole host of reasons, it's so important, I wondered that, you know, with this increasing recognition that, you know, green spaces and natural spaces are so important and crucial to urban life, coupled with this rise of this smart city movement, could technology step in where this biological communication network has been altered and disrupted? So that's the Internet of Nature. It's a framework for applying emerging or disruptive technologies to basically better value, understand, and manage these novel urban ecosystems that we live in.
That's really fascinating. So I love how you were like thinking about that as like, oh, there was perhaps a gap in the like networking capacity within an urban ecosystem. And you know, something like for me, like when we do like, I do like landscaping projects and we plant trees and stuff. And like we use, this brand called Orca. It's like, this is not like a product placement, I promise you. I just was, but they make this like mycorrhizal mix.
Right.
But you know, maybe there's like just practical policy things as well of like, we should be with urban forestry and horticulture, like having more education and resources for people working with plants to apply mycorrhizae.
Yeah, and I think what the Internet of Nature does is, well, what I like about using, you know, telling this story about the inspiration behind the Internet of Nature, and that it was based in, you know, this beautiful mycorrhizal communication system that exists in natural ecosystems. I think it also paints, hopefully, an enticing narrative for urban dwellers that might not know that trees in the wild actually communicate with each other. And that, you know, you could put it even, of course, as a scientist, it's a gross oversimplification, but you can say stuff like, in cities, trees aren't able to talk to each other. And when you talk about it in these ways, and Dr. Suzanne Simard, who really pioneered a lot of the work on mycorrhizal fungal networks in British Columbia's forests, she really put forward this idea that, you know, if we can better relate to trees in the sense like, okay, trees talk, I talk, you know, maybe we can better relate to them and therefore also increase the stewardship that we might have towards these beings and what that might do, well, in her case, for sustainable forestry, and in my case, for sustainable urban forestry.
That's super interesting. Kind of, you know, makes me think about like plant psychology or even like sociology. And it's like, think about what are humans facing in the urban context around just their emotions and managing their emotions and ability to like connect with other humans, right? And it's like that also happens with non-human species, I guess, you know, and plants too.
No, absolutely.
It like that's super interesting. But maybe like you're saying, maybe there are actually cool unmapped like communications going on even in cities, right? Where it's like. And that would be really interesting to see. It's like, oh, wow, it's like it's still going on, actually. You know, these trees are talking to each other. I would love to see some research like that.
Yeah, that would be like one of my biggest dreams would to one day see this interactive map that actually maps these fungal, you know, networks in real time. That would be, you know, almost this, you know, like a. Almost like how you can create these maps about social media networks. Like, yeah. Could we create a map of, you know, the social networks of urban trees? Like, I think that would be absolutely incredible to be able to visualize. And again, play such an important role in citizen engagement and getting people talking about the hard life that trees face in cities.
Okay.
And, you know, as we become more aware that trees are important for cities, it's important conversation to have.
That's interesting. I want to just like, if you'll allow me, just go in for a sec. Cause you said the word, we were using the word map. Mm-hmm. And one of the themes of this thing is I was interviewing another person, Richard Doyle, was just around like this idea of illumination and this digital layer that we're applying to things. Right. And it's like, how do you feel about this in terms of what is like, what is the value of a map and of these digital assets? Like, what is the purpose? What's the end goal here in terms of restoration and, you know, meeting our sustainability goals?
So for me, the motivation behind that is purely practical. And I think it really comes from this, you know, old adage that, you know, you can't manage what you don't measure. And I think if we're so aware of at the same time the benefits that urban trees give us, and on the other hand, you know, the hard life that trees, you know, have in cities, and that, you know, tree mortality rate is high, and that's something that we need, like many trees don't survive to be old enough in cities to actually be able to benefit from the wide array of ecosystem services that we've come to rely on these trees for. So if we've defined that as both as the intrinsic motivation and also the problem with trees, for me it all comes down to a question of, well, we need to be better at creating the data and analyzing that data and digesting it into, you know, quite complex informations, into actually digestible insights to be able to use for the better monitoring of these spaces should we want to improve them. So for me, it's really all about better monitoring.
Yeah.
And then also being able to, and to get really practical, at the end of the day, it's all about, you know, where you're putting your investments. And if you can't prove that, you know, a better monitoring and therefore a better interventions, well, those interventions need an investment. And if you can't, you know, prove that that intervention is actually having, you know, the impact that you want it to, it's going to be really difficult to get those investments year on year. And I know all around the world, you know, parks and rec and urban forestry departments and municipalities around the world, it's a constant battle to get the funds that you need to maintain the urban forest. And I think a layer, an additional layer of data with the analytics that go along with that, is hopefully a cheaper way to better assess the impact that those interventions can have.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think part of, like, I think part of it is that it has to do with economics, and that maybe in some degree, trees aren't really treated as valuable resources as they are, right? And we know that they're like NYC Parks did a great job with the NYC street map, calculating, estimating some of the green infrastructure benefits, the energy, the CO2 sequestration benefits, right? And then you can obviously equate those to dollars, which is, I love things like that. But I do think that in some degree, part of like what's missing is just the societies acknowledging that these are valuable and like creating systems to actually produce value from them. So we have trees, we have maple trees. Can we extract sap for sugars? You know, like, can we harvest branches and create household objects? Like, actually thinking, using the word forestry in the more traditional sense with urban forestry, mm-hmm. And like managing the resources, using them. What do you think about
that? I think that's a really exciting aspect of urban forestry that'll hopefully grow more and more, is looking at trees for more than an aesthetic value, but mm-hmm. even more than a carbon sequestration value or an intercepting stormwater value, but actually seeing them as these, multifunctional beings, which could also include providing fruit, as I know a lot of the work that you have done in the terms of urban foraging has focused on. I mean, these are incredible ways to get people on board in terms of tree stewardship, in a way that also, I mean, sounds selfish, but they get something out of it too.
Yes, and I have to shout out Falling Fruit, who really was one of the people who got me interested in this. I did my master's research on this app that basically, is just an interface over Google Maps, but it allows you to geotag edibles and create notes. It's awesome. About their, yeah. Stage, plant stage and harvesting notes and stuff. And it's really exciting and has a really like vibrant community. They are actually working with an organization now, I think a nonprofit, around getting young people to code. They're going to actually rehaul the app and kind of update it and stuff. So that's pretty exciting. But yeah, they're a big inspiration for sure for me.
It definitely speaks to kind of a larger trend that I'm super passionate about and want to focus more on in my work going forward. Is I remember reading this statistic that it came from the UK, I believe, that was something along the lines of that prison inmates spend more time outdoors on an average day than children in the UK do. And that children in the UK spend less than, if an inmate gets 2 hours of outdoor time a day, that children are spending less than 2 hours of their day outdoors. And especially, of course, this has to do with so many more people, but of course, so many more children living in urban centers. And I think the idea of, urban foraging is so exciting because it brings back all these, amazing memories that at least I have of my own childhood, of being able to enjoy an ecosystem for what it was and all of the things that it could give you. And a lot of these things, are potentially lost if you're a child growing up in a dense urban core. And it teaches children just such important lessons about, what nature is and how to be a better steward for it. And, this is the essence of life, and that life begins in the soil, and all these different things are just incredibly important lessons. And it's a shame not more, urban dwelling children have an opportunity to experience these things.
Well, and it's not just urban, it's probably suburban too, because I'm gonna butcher this stat, but I remember hearing about how it's like, at least kids in America, it's like they can name hundreds of brands, logos, corporate logos,
right,
but not like 10 plants,
or you're just like, right, I remember,
oh,
that,
my lord. Okay. So yeah, there's a big issue. My company, Plant Group, is working on something called Plant, which is people learning about nature together. We're going to be this spring doing some exciting environmental education greenhouse projects in New Jersey. where we're actually kind of learning about plants through a kind of horticulture education program in a greenhouse. And there's also some cool opportunity for like IoT, you know, standard temperature, humidity type stuff. One of the things I want to do is get one of these digital light microscopes, because you can connect it to a HDMI and a screen. So then we could just cut open a piece of celery and look at it under the microscope and show the kids that.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Right? Or maybe that's really take a cool. soil sample, you know?
No, it's brilliant. I mean, and that probably, as someone who grew up, you know, to be an ecological engineer, of course, kind of the love for nature and ecology was always there. But these kind of field trips of, you know, going into these like nature conservation centers and being able to take, you know, little mini water quality samples and stuff as like an 8-year-old, like those experiences like really, really, really stayed with me.
You had those experiences?
I grew up in a pretty typical like North American suburb, and there was, it was like a nature conservation center in a park that you would go to, and you once a year you would get the opportunity to, you know, as a class, go to the center and get a lesson for the day, whether it was from like a park ranger or like a field biologist or something, and you know you have to go out and collect bugs and identify them and stuff, and. Obviously, from personal experience, considering the interest I had even as a kid, this really stuck with me. But I just think that, whether or not you have a fascination with biology or not as a kid, like these experiences are just so important for just learning about the essence of life.
I think that it's safe to say that might have like changed the course of your life. Would you have been who you are now if you didn't have those parks classes or those classes?
I mean, hard to say. I mean, I'd like to think, of course, that the love for biology was there from the beginning, that I still would have, you know, embarked on this path, but sure. You're right. I mean, I think they had a huge role. And I think that there's more and more appreciation and these ideas that are thrown around outdoor classrooms or even having semesters abroad. Mm. There's this great when I was living in Boston this past year, I heard about this fantastic program that takes youth, especially at-risk youth, and takes them to basically do an entire semester of their high school outside. So it's like a boarding school. You sleep in cabins. You're in the middle of the woods, and every single class is outside.
Wow.
And I just, the testimonials, the stories that you would hear from these kids that went for this program, you know, kids that, you know, just had a really rocky home life and just didn't see much of a future opportunity, just what the outdoors did with them. It just,
It can bring me to tears.
I think it's so beautiful what experiences in the outdoors can do to people.
Oh, I hear you. Especially when like kids are involved with this stuff, I often have to just like stop talking. Cause I'm like, okay, I'm going to cry. Okay, just let me not talk.
Okay, so I'm not the only one. Good.
Yeah. No, so you're talking about, I want to connect these two ideas. So I love this idea of environmental education, and then we have Internet of Nature. So one, I would love to hear what are some exciting internet, you know, ION technologies coming out. And are there any that are like connecting education? Because that seems like a big opportunity.
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, to answer the first question, I think some of the technologies I'm most excited about is this idea of using sensor networks for real-time soil monitoring using, you know, mining social media for public opinion on green space or using a tree bot to do, you know, dangerous tree care work or using, you know, remote sensing to be able to map in a greater kind of temporal resolution some of the ecosystem services that we're getting from our urban forest. But I think especially when it comes to, let's take like, you know, an Internet of Things like sensor network, for example. Mm-hmm. I think that's an exciting prospect because it's something tangible. You know, you can build a sensor, you can touch a sensor. I mean, there's incredible, open source technology available for building a really low cost sensor. I mean, we can get into the data quality later, but at least you can, you know, have the experience of, you know, building this, you know, incredible low cost sensor. And, you know, these are things that kids can get involved with, that they're not only learning, you know, it's like a trifecta. One, you're learning the hardware side of things. You're building something with your hands. Mm. Two, you're learning the software side of things. You have to code the thing. You have to understand data analytics. You have to understand, okay, this sensor will take a measurement, and then that measurement is a piece of data, and where will that data go, and how is that data going to be processed through the cloud, and how am I going to analyze that data? What kind of insights am I going to get from that data? And then what's the intervention going to be based on that data? And then go into the field and, you know, touch the soil with their own hands and ground truth that data. There's so many different steps that I think, one, it's huge in terms of outdoors education, but it also touches upon the fact that, you know, we're living in 2020 in a digital world. And of course, we want to give our kids the skills for the future, which, you know, includes coding and includes being able to understand hardware and being able to understand technology from a young age. And it's strengths, but also its limitations. And there's no better way to do that than through real life exercises like this.
Well, absolutely. And to me, it's like, I think about, where is technology going? And I think there's a good amount of research just to show that it's going pretty heavy in this like augmented reality direction, or mixed reality. And like, there's one side of that spectrum, which is going to be what it is now, advertisers putting things in front of the boxes in front of our eyes, right? And it's going to be more immersive advertising experience. So that's one. And then I think almost like, I really feel like as technologists or creators, or artists, there's like an ethical thing of like counteracting that. So instead of having advertisers in our lenses, what about things to help us, like you're saying, think about trees more, or be more empathetic towards what trees are going through, you know?
No, absolutely. Because I think, I mean, to come back on an earlier point, understanding those struggles and being able to relate to those struggles, as weird as that sounds, that you would think you'd be able to relate to a tree. But I think when you do that kind of thing, you really build better tree stewards. So my name is Nadina Ghali. I'm an ecological engineer and entrepreneur. And you can find me on Twitter, LinkedIn, and my own website at nadinaghali.com. And I look forward to getting in touch.
All right, thanks everybody for tuning in to Talk Dirty. Check us out next month, December 2020, for our next episode, Traditional Ecological Knowledge in the Personhood of Nature. Really looking forward to seeing y'all there. In the meantime, if you have any questions or want to talk about the podcast, reach out to info@plantgroup.co or follow us on Instagram, plant_group.